Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week, we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey everybody, Robert Evans here again. As I stated last time, this episode ran very long, so we split it into two parts. I'm going to just dive in to the episode with Jake and I right now, so thanks for listening, watching, if you can see sound. In any case, here's more Bezos. Jeff had been a demanding taskmaster to his employees up to this point, but he also sounds like he was a reasonably well-liked boss. The complaints you hear later about him, he's very strict, he's very, like, dedicated, he wants a lot of work out of you. I haven't heard anything like allegations that he was abusive at this point, and that's because I think he's not really in charge. He's not running the company. He's got people above him, and I think that tempers some of what will later become his worst attributes as a boss. For some time, Jeff had been talking out different business ideas with his mentor, David Shaw. Many of these ideas were finance-focused, but one of the ideas they would talk about was what they called the Everything Store. Now, the internet was young back then, and it was still very small, but both men were enough future-focused to understand its potential and the fact that an online company that could sell products directly from manufacturer to consumer could save a fortune on store space and, among other things, and undercut retail chains. This was not a revolutionary idea. I'm sure a number of people realized this was going to happen at some point, but Jeff and David are talking about it very early on, and Jeff did come up with one innovative plan for how this store would work. His idea was that it should be driven by customer reviews. Any customer should be able to leave a review, and you know, all of those reviews should be collected, and you should get people buying should be like shown products based on which stuff is best reviewed. Now, this had never been done on a large scale. It's how the whole internet works now, but Jeff is really like kind of the first person who commits to doing this anywhere in internet commerce. And that's really when you're looking at kind of what set Amazon initially apart from other attempts, that was a big part of it. For a while, the Everything Store was a fun thought experiment for Shaw, but Bezos grew obsessed with it. In his free time, he would read analyses of the growth of the early internet. And in 1994, he came across information that web activity had surged by 230,000% in the last year. So he thought, quite accurately, that someone could make a shitload of money on the internet with a growth percentage like that. So he decides to quit his high-paying job because he's already very successful. He could have stayed at D.E. Shaw for the rest of his career. and almost certainly would have been a multimillionaire, you know, would have been a very successful career. But he wants more than that. So he quits his job, kind of baffles his mentor, and he and his new wife, Mackenzie, fly to Texas, grab a shit car from some family members, and drive to California. Mackenzie drives while Jeff spends the whole time like putting together spreadsheets and reading different sort of business laws and figuring out how he's going to make this company he wants to form work. One of the things he finds out on his drive is that due to a 1992 Supreme Court case, merchants did not have to collect sales tax in states they didn't operate in. And this is kind of the loophole that makes early Amazon.com possible. The fact that, like, again, when it because a big part of it is that they can really undercut prices. Part of that is we're not paying for a brick and mortar store, so we don't have to pay for like employees to stock shit. We don't have to pay for storage space. We can sell direct from the manufacturer. But part of it is because if you're an online retailer in this period, you don't have to collect sales tax from any state but the one you're in. So if people who live in the state that your business is operated in buy from you, they have to pay sales tax, but nobody else does, which again means you can undercut everybody else. So Jeff had initially picked California as the place to launch Amazon.com, but when he learns about this law, he moves to Washington State instead. And he picks Washington because, number one, no income tax in Washington. I think that has an impact on it. Number two, and I think the main reason he picks it is because it has really good infrastructure. Microsoft is based near Seattle, so it has the kind of infrastructure you need to create a tech company, but almost no one lives in Washington. The whole Pacific Northwest is very like sparsely populated. So it meant that like the least number of customers possible would have to pay sales tax for Amazon products, and no one in the other 49 states has to pay. The initial plan was to sell books, because virtually all books came from one or two distribution companies who already had good distribution infrastructure, and because books are comparatively simple to ship and store. The plan from the beginning, but from Jeff, was to make money selling a single product online and then branch out, eventually to selling everything. The first name for what would be called Amazon was very stupid. Jeff wanted to call it Kadabra Incorporated. Like Abracadabra? Yeah, that was his. He was really married to this name for a while. Which is terrible. And a lot of his friends tell him it's a bad name. There's kind of this like early journey where everyone around Jeff is being like, hey, how about this as a name? How about this as a name? Like one of his friends suggests, why don't we just call it makeitso.com based on like Captain Picard, who's TNG is on the air at the point, and that's like Jeff's favorite Star Trek character. I think they decide not to do that because I'm sure it would be copyright infringement. So they stick with Kadabra, even though everyone's trying to talk him out of it. He and Mackenzie get to Seattle. They rent a 3-bedroom home, which is their first headquarters. They operated out of the garage. And they immediately set to work starting a business. The first lawyer for what becomes Amazon, is the one who finally talks Jeff out of Kadabra Incorporated as a name. And he does so by pointing out that over the phone, it sounds like saying cadaver. And he's like, people, that's not going to do good for you. Yeah, it's not a bad point. Sitting together in their living room, Mackenzie and Jeff Bezos registered a number of domains with potential names. Awake.com, Browse.com, Bookmall.com. The name they kept coming back to was Relentless.com. They really like this name. Jeff loves that name. I think he prefers it to Amazon. I believe it is still his favorite possible name for his company.
Relentless.
Relentless. That's what he thinks is the best possible name for Amazon, I think.
No, that's rubbish, man.
I think it's shit. I think Amazon's a fine name for a company.
Yeah,
I think
it's fine.
Relentless is a bad name. But Jeff never is able to really let this go. He buys the relentless.com domain in 1994. He really tries to make this happen. Again, his friends kind of come together, friends and like early employees, and eventually are like, it's creepy, Jeff. Like, it's a creepy name for your store. People are not going, it's not going to be good for us. And Amazon, he finally gets convinced to pick Amazon. The reason they decide on it is that it kind of speaks to how grand his goal is, because the Amazon's the biggest river in the world, right? But it also is it's a placid name. It's not a name that scares anybody. But Jeff never gives up on relentless.com entirely. And in fact, Jake, if you open a browser right now and you type in relentless.com, it'll take you to Amazon.
Relentless.com. Jesus Christ, it
right?
does as
yeah.
well.
Isn't that wild?
What is wrong with this guy? Couldn't even give it to the drinks company, just like, nope.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, it's this. It's what we've been kind of coming back to and back to. It's like, he's never really changed as a person. Like, he liked, everything about him today is the same as when he was in fucking sixth grade, pretty much. And obviously, he wanted Relentless.com to be the name. I don't think he ever gets over that.
Relentless. It's relentlessenergy.com. That's so long, man.
Yeah.
Surely he could sell it to them.
Yeah. Another one of Amazon's victims, that energy drink company.
Yeah.
You know who else is a victim of Amazon, Jeff? Well,
tell
not
me.
Jeff, Jake.
Tell me.
The products and services that support this podcast.
Lovely.
Yeah. Actually, I'm sure a number of them sell products on Amazon, but whatever. We don't need to think about that. Ads. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
Bean Dad, The Dress. 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpert.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar on the business. I understand now, it is a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back. So, the same month that Jeff bought the Relentless.com domain, he drove down to Portland, Oregon to take a four-day course on bookselling, sponsored by the American Booksellers Association. He learned the ropes of the business, and soon they were off, selling books at a slow pace at first. And Jeff and his first couple of employees are like physically, because the way it works is they're buying books from one of the two distributors who sells books to all the bookstores. Like, they get an order, they order the book from the distributor, and then the distributor ships the book to them, and then they mail the book to the customer, right? They don't have a warehouse, they have a garage, so, like, they're getting books as they're ordered, and they're painstakingly mailing out each book themselves. And Jeff is, to his credit, involved in all of the shit work from the start. Like, he's putting stuff in packages, he's picking up deliveries, he's mailing them off, and so is McKinsey, and so are, like, they're all kind of doing everything, right? All of the early employees are doing every part of running the business. There's no warehouse staff, right? Like, Jeff is the warehouse, and so is McKinsey. Like, everyone is everything in early Amazon. That said, when it came to funding Amazon, other people did most of the heavy lifting. Amazon did start with $10,000 that Jeff Bezos had saved up himself, and another $84,000 in what are generally referred to as interest-free loans. Now, a lot of this money actually came from his first employees. He would basically, when he was bringing, he was hiring people he'd met elsewhere in business and saying, like, look, you come to this company, take a pay cut, and if you pay, I'll let you buy stock now, right? And, like, that's a big part of how he founds the early company. So, for example, his first employee is a guy named Shel Kaplan, who many consider the co-founder of the company and who Jeff later kind of betrays. Shel was Jeff's good friend, and he joins Amazon because he believes in the vision of the company so much that he takes a 50% pay cut and he pays $5,000 to buy stock when he joins in order to help fund the company.
Oh, he must be fucking loaded now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he did very, very well. And in fact,
just
like,
stock.
He considered buying more, but didn't want to gamble that much. And it's like, it worked out well for him.
Yeah.
Jeff's parents were the first angel investors he had, dumping $100,000 of their oil money into the venture in early 1995. Jeff told his parents there was a 70% chance they'd lose it all, explaining, "I want you to know what the risks are, because I still want to come home for Thanksgiving if this doesn't work." Which is at least respectable. From the beginning, Amazon's promise to customers was a bookstore that was always in stock. Now, they were really just letting regular people order books the same way that bookstores did, straight from the people who actually, like, kept them in a warehouse, and charging a premium for the privilege. The book distributors had a rule where they'd only ship a book if you ordered 10 at a time. Since Amazon wasn't selling enough books to order 10 books at a time generally, the company developed a sneaky strategy of ordering the book they needed and, like, 9 copies of an out-of-print book. If the books were out of stock or out of print, the order would get auto-canceled by the ordering software, and the one book that Amazon needed would get shipped their way. And so that's how they got over this limit, was kind of like fucking with the system and hurting this company's profitability that they were utterly reliant on. But at this stage, it's not really a big enough business that anyone notices what they're doing. In its first year of operation, Amazon required another cash infusion from Jeff's parents, this one of $145,000. So
fucking hell.
He gets, I mean, he's kind of funded by ExxonMobil, you know, like, his dad gets rich from ExxonMobil, and that's what allows Amazon to survive its first year or two.
What I don't get is, why did he need those big lumps of money from his parents? You know, he already had, like, a really good job. I know he quit, but did he not, like, save anything? You know what I mean?
I don't know. You know, it's 1982, I think. Weird. $10,000, which is what he invested in it, is more money. I don't know if it's that he made his parents put most of the investment in, or if he just, like, legitimately, that was kind of what you made in fintech at that point. I really don't know what his actual net worth was. But yeah, I mean, it is kind of worth noting, as a number of people will always point out, that, like, again, he's very reliant on his family money in order to, you know,
a couple $100,000. Like, yeah.
Yeah. It's not an insignificant investment. Again, the thing that all these guys have in common. That said, Bezos and his early employees knew that, like, mom and dad's money ain't going to keep going forever, and they have to pound the pavement to find investors. It was not an easy sell at first. Amazon, the year his mom and dad put $145,000 into the business, the company lost $300,000. Amazon is a loss leader for a while. Jeff told every potential investor that the company had a 70% chance of failing, but he projected net sales of $74 million by the year 2000. So he's like, yeah, we're losing money now, but we'll be making tens of millions of dollars by the year 2000. And it's one of those things, I think at the time, most people would have probably rightly been like, well, that is nonsense. Like, you're just pulling a number out of your ass. He was actually pessimistic with that estimate, because actual net sales for Amazon in the year 2000 were $1.64 billion. Now, Amazon still loses money in the year 2000. Up until like 2015, I think they're losing money constantly. But their income grows, and that's why people keep investing in them, and then they keep like reinvesting their profits back into expanding the business. So the investment money starts to come. In 1996, venture capitalists pour tens of millions of dollars into Amazon, and things begin moving very fast for Jeff. Amazon's first company motto was "Get Big Fast," which is also the motto for a significant portion of steroid Twitter. And I guess we could make a comment about all the testosterone Jeff appears to be taking these days. But
yeah, you got a lot of it now.
Yeah, he got big fast, that's for sure. Yeah. The company had its IPO in 1997. It succeeded in winning a stupid legal fight with Barnes & Noble, who are like desperate to try to kill Amazon, but not quite smart enough to figure out how. And it expands from books to CDs, DVDs, toys, and electronics. In his first letter to shareholders, Jeff Bezos and some of his early employees wrote, "This is day one for the internet, and if we execute well, day one for Amazon.com." Now, that is important because it's become kind of like a religion within Amazon corporate culture. You will hear day one constantly. There's day one posters everywhere. Jeff regularly emphasizes the need for day one thinking, treating what they're doing like it's the first time anybody's done it. Again, not a bad way to, obviously, this is a part of the company's success. That's not a bad way to look at things if you're trying to innovate them. For its first few years, Amazon grew meteorically. Bezos was person of the year in 1999, which actually causes some problems for him, because the article itself and all the attention generated by this fawning piece helps to send a flood of customers to Amazon for holiday season 1999. And this is the first time Amazon has a huge holiday season. They've recently expanded to products other than books, and they get all this media attention, and people start flooding there to like buy Christmas presents and Hanukkah presents and stuff from them. And Bezos had put millions in investment capital into expanding Amazon for this moment. This had been his goal and was part of the strategy. But they kind of fuck it up, because actually keeping, number one, keeping the most popular toys in stock proved to be kind of impossible. They were selling too fast, but a bunch of other stuff they bought didn't sell. And so like their warehouses are filled with unsold inventory while people can't get the products that they actually want. It's enough of like a clusterfuck, and largely caused by issues with the warehouse, right? Like he hadn't scaled up distribution enough in order to actually handle the demand. They've only got like five warehouses at this point. So this causes enough of a calamity that it results in this like flood of bad press. Journalists start writing articles about how Amazon stock is overvalued and like the company is about to come to a crashing end. And it's actually really kind of an existential threat for Amazon. And in order to kind of meet the threat, Bezos institutes what he calls a Save Santa operation. He forces his like all of his employees, so like the guys who are like coding, the people who are like doing marketing, the people who are like all of his like actual staff employees, he forces to take 2 weeks each, leave their families, and spend 2 weeks of the holidays staffing customer service lines or working distribution in like isolated warehouses. To save money, workers were kept two to a hotel room. And I'm going to quote from the Everything Store here to talk about this first big Amazon holiday season. In Fernley, some employees stayed at the Golden Nugget in Reno, and after they worked at the graveyard shift, they met for beers at the casino bar at 6 a.m. Later, a few swore they had been working alongside furloughed prisoners from a nearby jail, though that is difficult to prove. Early employee Tom Schoenhoff was among the group that went to Delaware, where the facility was having problems with the quality of the temporary labor pool. There were a lot of temp workers that looked like the rehab center had pushed them out the back door, he says. He watched one worker get fired for intoxication and then wet himself while he tried to protest.
Fucking so hell. That's yeah, really grim.
We're starting to see the beginnings, right, of like
yeah.
the Jeff we know today. It was enough of a debacle that some executives, and it's kind of a mix of how badly the Christmas season goes and how in like the how infuriated they are by this Time article where he like is fluffing himself and it leads to a lot of this rush on Amazon. Some executives try to push him out of his company. They call him impetuous and controlling. And this sparks a fight with the board, an alleged fight with the board. Some board members deny it happened. There are other people who were executives at the time who say it happened. There's this fight to try to oust Jeff. And this is not that long after Steve Jobs had been ousted from Apple, right? There's this period where Jobs gets forced out of Apple. He creates a computer company. He creates Pixar. Jeff manages to avoid this happening because he keeps a majority of Amazon stock. Right. But the early years are rough. And, you know, there's a lot of people saying Amazon is dead in the like 2000, 2001, people saying the company's never going to survive another couple of years. Bezos actually gets investigated for insider trading in 2001 because of like how bad some of the financial decisions he makes are. And the company is just bleeding money through its early years. Like their profits are increasing rapidly, but they are just like pissing cash into a fucking trash fire. That said, by the early aughts, things had started to stabilize and the company began to grow like exponentially its profitability. And again, they're still losing money, but they're growing profits by so much that investors are willing to keep pumping money into the company because they're like, well, if we stop reinvesting in the company, eventually there will be dividends and shit for us. It's just, yeah, you know, that's kind of like how he sells this to them. And you know the broad strokes of the rest of the story, Jake. Everybody does because we've all lived through it, right? Amazon expands steadily. And despite losing to Apple in the digital music race, because Jeff Bezos doesn't understand music, the company rises to become the globe-striding colossus we all know today. To close us out, then, I think the best thing I could do, rather than sort of like, oh, let's talk about how they started Amazon Web Services, or let's talk about how they expanded in the television, right? I think the best way I could actually close us out today is to hone in on the first stirrings of two problems that are kind of the main things Amazon gets criticized for today. Number one would be its relentless, obsessive, and unhealthy work culture. And number two would be the callous disregard for human warehouse workers in its distribution centers, or fulfillment centers, as they call it. The first major publication to report on Amazon's corporate culture in a really critical way was the New York Times in 2015. Here's how it opened. They are told to forget the poor habits they learned at previous jobs, one employee recalled. When they hit the wall from unrelenting pace, there is only one solution. Climb the wall, others reported. To be the best Amazonians they can be, they should be guided by the leadership principles, 14 rules inscribed on handy laminated cards. When quizzed days later, those with perfect scores earn a virtual award proclaiming, "I'm peculiar," the company's proud phrase for overturning workplace conventions. And one of the things that really separates Amazon from the other big dot-com startups like Google, they don't go to any real efforts to make it comfortable or to like give perks to employees. Like you get money and you'll get stock and you can get rich working at Amazon. But like there is like, there's no like massage rooms. There's no like game rooms for chilling out in like Google gets famous for. Like Amazon's whole thing is like
slide at Google. Like, yeah,
you are going to work like yourself to the bone at Amazon. That's the promise we make you. The Times cites employees like Bo Olson, a book marketer who said his main memory of Amazon was seeing people weep at their desks. You walk out of a conference room and you'll see a grown man covering his face. Nearly every person I worked with, I saw cry at their desk. Much of the harshness and irrational workaholism was justified by the near sanctified 14 rules Bezos had for his employees. Quote, according to early executives and employees, Mr. Bezos was determined almost from the moment he founded Amazon in 1994 to resist the forces he thought sapped businesses over time. Bureaucracy, profligate spending, lack of rigor. As the company grew, he wanted to codify his ideas about the workplace, some of them proudly counterintuitive, onto instructions simple enough for a new worker to understand, general enough to apply to the nearly limitless number of businesses he wanted to enter, and stringent enough to stave off the mediocrity he feared. The result was the leadership principles, the articles of faith that describe the way Amazonians should act. In contrast to companies where declarations about their philosophy amount to vague platitudes, Amazon has rules that are part of its daily language and rituals, used in hiring, cited at meetings, and quoted in food truck lines at lunchtime. Some Amazonians say they teach them to their children. The guidelines conjure an empire of elite workers. Principle number 5, hire and develop the best, who hold one another to towering expectations and are liberated from the forces, red tape, office politics, that keep them from developing their utmost. Employees are to exhibit ownership, number 2, or mastery of every element of their businesses, and dive deep, number 12, or find the underlying ideas that can fix problems or identify new services before shoppers even ask for them. And the indoctrination that goes on in Amazon, that like to get people kind of roped into this idea, the overwork that comes with it is all so consuming that employees take to calling themselves Amabots with a mix of like pride and resignation. Like there's an element of pride that we're like robots for Jeff's big vision. Being the ultimate data guy, Jeff takes full advantage of the fact that Amazon's online nature gives him like a wider variety of metrics than any other boss has ever had to analyze and judge how the human beings in his company are working. Employee evaluations are often 50 to 60 pages long, filled with numbers like on people's performance that employees are expected to memorize. And then they'll get cold called by their managers. And if they haven't memorized all the different numbers about their metrics and aren't able to like explain or justify them, they get in trouble. Quote from the Times, explanations like "we're not totally sure" or "I'll get back to you" are not acceptable, many employees said. Some managers sometimes dismissed such responses as stupid or told the workers to just stop it. And in this, Amazon is very much taking after its founder. And I'm going to quote here from the Everything Store to talk about how Jeff actually refers to, like, speaks directly to the people who work for him. Bezos was prone to melodramatic temper tantrums that some Amazon employees called privately nutters. A colleague failing to meet Bezos's exacting standards would predictably set off a nutter. If an employee did not have the right answers or tried to bluff the right answer or took credit for someone else's work or exhibited a whiff of internal politics or showed any kind of uncertainty or frailty in the heat of battle, the vessel in Bezos's forehead popped out and his filter fell away. He was capable of both hyperbole and cruelty in these moments, and over the years he delivered some devastating rebukes to employees. Among his greatest hits, collected and relayed by Amazon veterans, are, "I'm sorry, did I take my stupid pills today? Are you trying to take credit for something you had nothing to do with? Are you lazy or just incompetent? I trust you to run world-class operations, and this is another example of how you are letting me down. If I hear that idea again, I'm going to have to kill myself. Does it surprise you that I don't know that you don't know the answer to that question? And why are you ruining my life?"
Some of them were pretty funny. I mean, it's pretty bad, but I wouldn't say they're like, it's not like abusive, you know?
No,
what
and
I mean?
you can see with that both how someone could be like really fucked up by that, especially if like you devote your whole life to this company and then your boss just dismissively said you're ruining. But you can also see how people would find that like intoxicating and would draw into a guy like that and would be desperate to like please him and get positive.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Well, when it's paired with all that, 14 rules, like, it's very cult-like.
Yeah, exactly. So you can see both why people would find it off-putting, but also why that would inspire people to work even harder, you know? In 2013, Amazon hired Elizabeth Willett, a former army captain who'd served in Iraq. After some time, she had a child, and she arranged with her boss to come to work earlier and leave earlier so that she could pick up her baby, and then she would get on her laptop and work from home. Her boss told her this was fine, but her colleagues thought she was skipping work because she was leaving early, and they didn't know she was coming in early, and they informed on her to the boss that she'd gotten approval from to do this.
Oh.
That boss then attacked her, saying, "I can't stand here and defend you if you're peers are saying you're not doing your work." And this is kind of emblematic of a dark trend at Amazon, which is that a lot of these 14 principles and the system of coworker evaluations, often based on the principles, wind up being used uncommonly often to attack specific groups of employees. And one of the things that like women who work there will note is that one of these 14 principles is you have to be honest. And one of the pieces of criticism that like female employees get from their coworkers at Amazon is that they're all dishonest. Like that's a common, it's a part of why there's very few women in high management. And one of the claims they'll make is that like, well, these principles are used as a justification to attack us and just say that like, well, you're not following the principles. When in reality, it's just like, people kind of being shitty towards women in the way that they often are. It's an allegation.
It's very cult-like, that shit. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That's actually, and it's like mind games. That's like abusive type shit. Like, he gave her the permission and then he's having a go at her for something that, you know, essentially he should have told the colleagues, it's none of your business. Like, stop informing. Like, but no, it's like, no, that person's in trouble. That's fucking weird. That's not right.
Well, and it's, again, because Jeff isn't directly involved in that story, but the system he's built is. And part of part of why that boss is doing that is that that boss is going to get evaluated by all of their employees. And so the boss, even though he gave her permission to do this, even though she's been doing a great job, he can't defend her because then his subordinates will criticize him. And so he throws her under the bus to protect his own career. And that's the that is how the system Jeff built works, right? That's it working as intended. Which is kind of fucked up, I would argue. And it gets fucked up at her, because again, that story is one of the less unsettling ones. From the Times, a woman who had thyroid cancer was given a low performance rating after she returned from treatment. She says her manager explained that while she was out, her peers were accomplishing a great deal. Another employee who miscarried twins left for a business trip the day after she had surgery. "I'm sorry, the work is still going to need to get done," she said her boss told her. "From where you are in life trying to start a family, I don't know if this is the right place for you." A woman who had breast cancer was told that she was being put on a performance improvement plan, Amazon code for "you're in danger of being fired," because difficulties in her personal life had interfered with her fulfilling her work goals. Their accounts echoed others from workers who had suffered health crises and felt they had also been judged harshly instead of being given time to recover. And that's not unique at Amazon. It's just, again, it's part of the system that Jeff has built. Now, when this report, this New York Times article drops, Amazon makes statements about, like, we're going to investigate a lot of these claims. Like, this is not us. Jeff Bezos sends out a letter saying, like, what's described in this New York Times article isn't the Amazon that I know or that our employees know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the standard kind of PR flack response to this shit. There are some changes made to the employee self-review process, but fundamentally nothing changes about the way the company treats its own people. Because again, to Jeff, the human beings that work for Amazon are both like robots that are there to execute his ideas, but they're also there to be targets for his anger when things go wrong. And a good example of this comes from the first Prime Day, which is Amazon's big sales day. And the very first Prime Day occurs in 2015. Amazon programmers and other staff work 24-hour days in order to prepare the site to host its first massive sales event, which went on to be the biggest sales day in company history. So this is a huge success by any kind of financial metric, right? They announce this thing, they roll out this big day of sales, and it's the best they've ever done, right? But the rollout of the software that organized the deals was imperfect. So, like, they're kind of algorithmically picking which stuff to put on sale. Some of the products that they're relying on to be big sellers sell out, and so people can't get them. Other, like, weird products, like, there's, like, discounts on Pop-Tarts and shit, and people are like, I can't get these electronics that obviously I want, but you're trying to get me to buy these discounted Pop-Tarts. It doesn't hurt, again, it's the best sales that the company's ever had. It doesn't hurt them financially, but there's a bunch of people on, like, Twitter making fun of Amazon because of some, like, technical glitches, and this, to Jeff Bezos, completely wipes out the fact that they've made the most money they've ever made. People are making fun of Amazon, and so he's furious at the people who have just executed his dream to do Prime Day, right? I think a reasonable person would be like, yes, of course some weird shit went wrong around the edges. We made the most money ever. This is worth celebrating. Jeff is furious.
I wouldn't give a shit.
Yeah,
my
they
whole
make like
website
$35 million in a
yeah,
day.
I'd be like,
oh,
well,
yeah.
Going to buy 10 houses. Like, you know
yeah.
what I mean?
But Jeff gets really fucking angry. And I'm going to quote here from the book Amazon Unbound. Behind the scenes, Jeff lost his mind over the negative online reaction, said Craig Berman, a senior PR vice president who was at his son's swim meet in Oregon when all hell broke loose. He was screaming at me and my team that we needed to be clear that these aren't shitty deals. He was being maniacal, saying, "Get this fixed! You've got to show this is a success!" And yeah, it's, you know, it's the kind of, like, poisoned internet brain a lot of big wealthy people have, where it's like, I mean, by any measure of the word success, this is a success, but people are angry at you on Twitter, so you're like, you're broken about it.
I you know, I really can't get my head around that. I mean, you know, I'm one for Twitter and that, it's fine, like, it's decent. Mm-hmm. But if you had all the money in the world, why, like, oh, I'll argue with this person on Twitter? You can go and do anything. I'd be on a quad bike, like, just doing something. You know what I mean? Like, oh, someone's mad on Twitter. Bye. Like, it's just, you're right. It's like a poison. You know what I mean? But I think it comes with ego, you know, and everything he built.
Yep. I think so. It's because this company is, like, fundamentally extremely personal to him.
Yeah, exactly.
It is the core of his identity. Yep. Cool shit. There is probably no better example of how uncaring and actively harmful Jeff can be towards his employees than the story of Amazon's fulfillment centers. We've all seen articles that dropped early this year about people pissing in bottles to make the inhuman metrics for cargo moved or packages delivered. You have a show, you know, Megacorp is largely about this. This is a big part of Megacorp is like Amazon fulfillment center workers and how they're treated. Yeah. And so at the end of this episode, I'd like to talk about how that system started, right? Like the very early days of what led to this, people pissing in bottles and like passing out and stuff on the work floor and RV cities setting up outside of FCs in order to keep them, like all that shit. Mm-hmm. So the man who largely built Amazon's fulfillment center system was Dave Clark. He was a former middle school band teacher who got hired in 1999 when the company had only 7 warehouses in the U.S. By 2012, when he becomes head of global operations, Amazon has 40 warehouses in the U.S. and 24 other warehouses worldwide. But these were located mostly in the middle of nowhere. So at this point, 2012, Amazon has a bunch of warehouses, like 60, 70 in the world, but they're all in like really inconvenient places. And the reason why they're in inconvenient places is those are generally the places with the cheapest labor and also the most advantageous for tax purposes. So he'll set up like the warehouses will be in some bumfuck town in the middle of nowhere because that town gives them a tax break and because it's cheap to hire workers around there, right? And that makes sense for a company that isn't trying to do what Amazon starts trying to do, right? That can work great if you're just trying to sell products online, minimize your costs. But if you're obsessed with the idea that like there should be 2-day or 1-day shipping, you can't do that. You have to have a fulfillment center in every major city if you're going to do that kind of business, right? So Dave Clark is the guy who kind of oversees the pivot from we have our warehouse system set up in order to maximize the amount of stuff that we can hold and ship out and minimize the costs to we don't care about minimizing the costs anymore. We care about getting as many fulfillment centers started as possible so that we can get products to people in a day or two, right? And that's because, again, it's become such of like Amazon's 2-day shipping has become such a part of just like life now that it's not until like right around when the Trump years start that like they actually get this really off the ground. You know, it's fairly recent that this has been an aspect of modern life that you could expect 2-day shipping on your Amazon products. It's just kind of taken over everything because it's it offers such close to instant gratification.
Sometimes like same day.
Yeah. I've had shit arrive like same day that I didn't even like try to order same day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same. It just happened.
Yeah. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
Bean Dad, The Dress. 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene. I've lost all on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano!
Jean, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, over the next 5 years, Amazon adds 100 fulfillment centers worldwide. And this is where most of their gargantuan, like, huge warehouses and, like, that are in every city, kind of, or at least on the outskirts of every city, this is where all that comes from. So Dave Clark's the guy who's, like, expanding massively the fulfillment center system so that they can do this. Now, at the same time, Amazon, they realize they can't rely on like UPS or USPS. So they get their own like fleet of planes, but they don't. So one of the things Amazon does with its warehouses and with everything is they never want to interface with unions in any way, shape or form ever. They never want to like in any way deal with them. This is a problem with getting your own planes because pilots are unionized, right? So Amazon basically leases planes from a company that actually runs everything and hires the pilots so that they don't have to deal directly with unionized pilots. And they structure their distribution network very carefully to avoid any unionized warehouse workers. This also allows them to avoid scrutiny over the hours worked or miles driven by people in distribution. When this starts killing people because drivers are involved in crashes, they run people down on the side, what people like are dying in the warehouses. You can find a bunch of stories about this. And when those stories start to come out that there's like drivers crashing and killing people trying to make Amazon's like metrics, there's backlash, you know, both from the media, from public outcry, and from some people inside of Amazon itself. One of these people is Mark Onetto. Mark was head of operations in the mid-aughts, and he introduced a number of innovations to try and make fulfillment centers run more smoothly. He was also very concerned with the treatment of employees in these fulfillment centers, and he tried to force empathy for employees onto Jeffrey Bezos. Quote from Amazon Unbound. In 2009, Onetto's human resources deputy, David Niekirk, wrote a paper titled Respect for People and presented it at an S-Team meeting. The S-Team is like Jeff and his like trusted advisors, right? Like it's the top of the Amazon empire.
The S-Team. Paper,
yeah, the S-Team. God. Yeah. The paper drew from Toyota's proven lean ideology and argued for treating people fairly, building mutual trust between managers and associates, and empowering leaders to inspire employees rather than act as disciplinarians. Bezos hated it. He not only railed against it in the meeting, but he called Niekirk the following morning to continue the browbeating. Amazon should never imply that it didn't have respect for people embedded in the very fabric of how it operated, he said. Bezos also solemnly declared that one of the biggest threats to the company was a disgruntled and entrenched hourly workforce, like the unionized workers that impaired U.S. automakers with strikes and onerous contract negotiations. Amazon later denied that Bezos said this. He encouraged Niekirk and Onetto to focus on ensuring that FC workers who weren't advancing within Amazon stayed for a maximum of 3 years. He like cancels bonuses, makes it impossible for people to get raises past a certain point. Like, rather than we shouldn't be enabling the self-respect of our fulfillment center workers, we should make sure there's as much turnover as possible so that nobody's there very long, so that no kind of culture can form, so that people don't get to identify themselves as part of a community of laborers and unionize. So Onetto is pushing against this. Bezos pushes back. And Onetto's end at the company comes in 2011 when a local Pennsylvania paper reports that an Amazon warehouse near Allentown had gotten so hot during the summer that workers had passed out and been taken to hospitals. And Amazon had been so aware of the danger that they had ambulances just waiting outside for when people passed out, right? Like that this was like, they were, yeah, of course, X number of employees are going to pass out in our unair-conditioned warehouses in the dead of summer, and we'll just keep ambulances on site.
There was in my research, I actually spoke to someone that spoke to the workers there, and they were saying that in the offices, when people went in to complain, they had the aircon on full blast in the office, but in the warehouse they had nothing. Like, it's so grim.
And here's the thing, Onetto had seen this coming, and in fact, months earlier, he'd presented a white paper to Bezos and other top brass about rooftop air conditioners in FC facilities, and said they would cost like $52 million, but he was like, we need to do this. It's going to be necessary both for maintaining productivity and taking care of our people. Bezos himself shut down the request to put in air conditioners. Now, when the story goes viral that workers are passing out, he immediately approves air conditioners for the FCs. Like, right? It's this kind of thing where he's like, no, we're not going to spend that money. Oh, now people are yelling at us. Now it's bad PR. We'll do it now. And then after he's forced to like put in air conditioners, he attacks Onetto for not stopping the disaster. The guy who'd been like, we have to do this, and Jeff had said no, Jeff goes after him and blames him for the fact that there's bad PR. And I'm going to quote from Amazon Unbound and like how he does this. Fuming, Onetto prepared to remind Bezos of his original proposal. Colleagues begged him to let it go, but he couldn't. As they anticipated, the meeting did not go well. Bezos said that as a matter of fact, he did remember the paper, and that it was so poorly written and ambiguous that no one had understood what course of action Onetto was recommending. As other S-team members cringed, Bezos declared that the entire incident was evidence of what happens when Amazon puts people in top jobs who can't articulate their ideas clearly and support them with data. And I think it's because the actual data, like, Jeff was willing to accept, oh, we'll lose X productivity in order to save this amount of money by not air conditioning our factory or FCs. It's worth it. Onetto was saying, like, it's bad to do this to people. And the thing that Jeff's data didn't account for is that, like, well, it may not have cost you money, but it did cost you bad PR when it came out that you were doing this to your workers, and that hurt your bottom line. But no data that Onetto could have presented would ever have made that case, right? There was no like white paper saying this is how much money we'll lose when the New York Times writes a story about this, you know?
I still don't think he's fully grasped that. It's like, you know, he's made more money than he's ever made throughout the COVID, and union workers, you know, doing the most efforts right now to unionize, and he's still just spending millions and millions trying to stop them. You know what I mean? Rather than just being like, yeah, you know what? We made loads and loads of money. Yeah. Okay, let's put it back in. Let's actually fix this. And it's just, no, he's just not having it.
Yeah, it's the kind of like you split 1% of Amazon profits among FC workers, and suddenly you've got a workforce that's like a lot more you would have much more career people, you'd have less turnover, but whatever. I know, I'm not a businessman. Yeah. It would also be at least less unethical. So the guy who Onetto leaves after this, like he quits, I think, the very next year. And the guy who takes over from Onetto spearheads a bid to acquire a company called Kiva. Kiva is a robotics startup. They make machines that can transport merchandise containers around warehouses and streamline the whole process. Before Kiva, Amazon pickers had walked upwards of 12 miles a day to grab products and take them to shipping. Kiva bots are able to kind of like move all of the shipping containers in these warehouses around in order to make things more efficient so that workers have to walk less and can pack more per like hour. And these robots really start to hit their stride in warehouses around 2014. They increase the amount of products per square foot at an Amazon FC by 50% because it's just so much more efficient. But they come with downsides too, primarily for the human workers. Quote, the robots also transformed labor that was physically exhausting, characterized by endless walking, into work that was instead mentally straining, with employees standing in place monotonously repeating the same movements over and over. A 2020 report in the Center for Investigative Reporting's Reveal magazine cited an OSHA letter to Amazon that said the robots exposed employees to ergonomic risk factors, including stress from repeated movements and standing up for 10 hours a day. Just as the tyrannical, invisible force of software guided the robot swarms, it also monitored worker performance, flagging any quantifiable decrease in productivity and subjecting employees to performance improvement plans and possible termination. And that at this point, we're where we are when Megacorp starts. Jake, this is kind of what feeds into all that. Like, this is how this is, you know, it all makes sense, right? None of it is a surprise.
It makes a lot more
backstory.
Sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. The data thing is just like this obsession with data above just humanity, basically, is kind of, you know, the stage that, you know, that all of this is kind of dancing on, you know what I mean? And it's just, it's like, it's almost like unintentional horrors. It's just like, yeah, like just not even caring, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, whatever, the data doesn't show this. It's like, mate, these are human beings with families and lives that gotta, you know what I mean, gotta eat, but the data doesn't, you know, it doesn't show that level of kind of context. It's just kind of sad, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is kind of sad, but that's the That's the podcast. That's the episode.
Yeah.
So we got
for you. Going over it all. It's very jolly.
Yeah, it's fun. Everybody, so, you know, consider this part one and consider listening to Megacorp to get the full story. Now you know who Jeff Bezos is. It's time to learn in detail every fucked up thing his company's done.
Yeah. Definitely. And, you know, I would say it's not exactly... A lot of people have been like, oh, it's not exactly the most uplifting podcast. It's like, well, no. What did you think was going to happen? This is about scandals, you know, one of the, arguably the biggest kind of company on earth in a way. So, yeah, no, it's not. But like I said in the kind of, in the intro to the thing, you know, if you have ever bought anything from Amazon, I think you should at least have to be aware of the way you know, they operate. And it's not just about the workers. We're going to be going into like the surveillance, the deals they did with MI6 and the CIA, like there's so many layers to it.
Absolutely. And check out Megacorp. Jake, you have anything else you want to plug?
I mean, if anyone wants to just check out my work, just go to jakehanrahan.com and you just see all my links and whatever.
Yeah. All right. Check out Jake Hanrahan. Check out Popular Front. Check out Megacorp and check out of the internet now and go do something offline. You've spent enough time online today.
Agree.
Yeah. All right. Damn.
Bean Dad. The Dress. 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus. And every week we take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who are they? What made them so notorious? How did the internet or the algorithm choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.